Good morning. Sorry for the starting a little late. It's 13 after 9 a.m., April 2nd, 2009. There's just, as we get into the end of the session, towards the end of the session, things start getting moved around a little bit schedule-wise. But we'll still continue to try to start on time. And I would like to welcome everybody to Senate Finance and again call Senate Finance Committee to order. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas. And we are going to, for the next several days, work on Senate Bill 161, which is appropriations non-transportation stimulus. This is the second hearing on this bill, and we heard had the first hearing on the 23rd. The intent with the hearing today and tomorrow is to continue our work on the bill by hearing the affected departments. Today, we've invited the Departments of Public Safety, Revenue, and Health and Social Services, and we're going to take them in that order. Tomorrow, we'll have the Department of Environmental Conservation, Labor, and Education, and there may be a little spillover today. We're going to go until the clock runs us out of time. And then the meeting today and tomorrow is by invitation only. Monday, which is the 6th of April, is going to be the day for public testimony, and we'll start that at 9 a.m. and conclude it at 11. Again, that's public testimony on Monday concerning this bill. The next 2 days, we're going to be exploring with the administration and our committee members here the items that have been excluded in the bill. And with us today is Ms. Karen Rayfield, the OMB director. She can come forward. And we're going to start with public safety. We're going to, I think, lead off with the administration. We also have Mr. Larry Pursley here and Jesse Kyle. Both Larry Pursley is from House Finance, and Jesse Keel is with Senate Finance. And we are not above hijacking our colleagues from the House Finance. So we will be cycling in and out some of the chairs today on the presentations because of the limited space at the head of the table, and we'll kind of probably after we do a couple of departments, we'll have the rhythm down for the rest of them. So the first one might be a little more discombobulated, I guess, as we move through this initial process. But Ms. Rayfield, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent, and start us off with public safety, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. Karen Rayfield with the Office of Management and Budget. And with me this morning at the table is Joellen Hanrahan, who's our senior policy analyst, who's been working very diligently on the economic stimulus package and is our source of information and coordination with state agencies. I want to thank you this morning for taking up the bill and talking about some of the items specifically that were not included in SB 161 that the governor introduced a couple of weeks ago. We know, as we've worked through the stimulus package, working with our state and federal agencies and also with you and your staff, we are getting more and more information about the requirements for receipt and expenditure of these funds, what the state of Alaska would need to do in order to be eligible to apply for funds, what the costs of doing so would be, and what the long-term costs or benefits to the state would be. When the governor rolled out the legislation before you without some of these items, the discussion really is about what those requirements are and how we can manage expectations in the future, specifically in those areas that are more along the lines of the operating budget. And I know you just completed your work on the operating budget, and we're all very concerned about long-term general fund expenditures in the operating budget. You may know that the governor did submit the required certification called the Section 1607 certification, dated the 31st of March. to meet those timelines required in the law, and also the legislature has adopted their resolution regarding acceptance of funds. So I think at this point we've preserved the options as we go forward and work on the individual components of the bill and make decisions about what appropriations will ultimately come from the legislature and then be decided finally or ultimately by the governor, which is the next step in the process, is the appropriation bill. And I know that she's very appreciative of your efforts and the public hearings that you've had on the bill. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to the Department of Public Safety, and they can start walking through the specific requests with the committee.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Rayfield. Just so everybody's kind of on the same page, I met with Ms. Rayfield yesterday for, well, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half or something like that, late yesterday. And she will not be joining us for most of the day. She's got other budgetary issues she has to deal with. So she was just here for the introduction, and she's going to have other staff from the administration and different departments stand in for her as we walk through this system today. So I just want the members to know, the committee, why you won't see Ms. Rayfield in the room.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming in. And go ahead. And first up is item number 26. It's page 3 of the spreadsheet dated March 30th. We want to watch our spreadsheet date. It's March 30th is the one we're working off of. I think we have two in our packet. So again, it's page 3, item 26. And if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and explain to the committee item number 26, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dan Spencer, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, item number 26 is a $50,000 item. This is funding that would come from the municipality of Anchorage. Right now, the municipality of Anchorage gets a direct grant from the Department of Justice related to internet crimes against children enforcement. They work with us. We have about a $50,500 memorandum of agreement with the municipality. We expect that when the municipality gets some additional funds from the stimulus, which is going to head directly to the municipality, it's over $400,000, that they will continue to work with us using those stimulus funds, and that's what this item represents. Their funding that they provide to us pays for overtime, some of our supplies, and some of our other costs. It does not provide for directly for additional personnel. So this is in anticipation of that. We haven't worked out a final agreement with the municipality on receiving any of the funds from them that come to them through the stimulus program, but they have indicated that they do expect to reach that agreement with us.
Okay, and you had mentioned personnel. Could you please repeat that issue?
Mr. Chairman, the existing funding that we get from the municipality pays for some overtime, some supplies, and some of the other costs, some travel, related to working with them on the enforcement of internet crimes against children. It does not fund a position per se.
Okay, and one of the things we're cognizant about is future impacts on our budget and unfunded mandates and strings attached and all that other related items. So looking into the future, what's the department's position on budgetary impacts out after the stimulus time frame has expired?
Mr. Chairman, on this particular item, we do not see any budgetary impact. If the funding goes away, when it goes away, then we wouldn't be working the overtime on those cases. It would be chargeable to them.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It states here that the only eligible applicant is the Anchorage Police Department. Why would they subgrant the funds to the state instead of using the funds themselves?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, they're already doing that. They already have one of these grants that is a regular grant, not a stimulus-related grant. And so the stimulus funds is going to give them the extra money to put more enforcement effort out there, and they've indicated that they will work with us in the same fashion that they are doing today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So the department has found the no strings attached issue with this item?
Mr. Chairman, we don't see any strings attached to this item.
Mr. Persley, could you come forward, please? We have an extra seat up there. It's we got three microphones, so we'll. I think what we'll do is have the department, like on this one, introduce the item, give us their viewpoint on it, and then we're going to have our trusty aide that we've borrowed from down the hall, if he has any comments on the particular issues or what he's found in doing the research for the legislature position. And Mr. Persley, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you work for and represent, and then if you could help us with this. Do you
have any comments? For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Larry Persley. I'm an aide to Representative Hawker in the House Finance Committee. And item 26 that you're looking at, the $50,000, we found no strings, no issues with this.
Okay.
This was an easy one.
Okay. Do we have any questions, other questions from the committee members on item 26? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of the concern was based more than actual strings attached, because that's why I think the Senate took the position that it did to take the money. But the expectation, the future expectations, which I think the chairman just also brought up that concept, has that been a rethinking on the department's behalf that whether people have expectations that something may continue and that state money would then have to replace the federal stimulus money? Has that been a rethinking of that, to that point that people are saying that's not a big deal, we can cut back, we're gonna, like I believe you already said, there won't be as much overtime or some other things done? Is that accurate understanding?
Mr. Chairman, I represent Senator Thomas. Yes, that is correct. When this memorandum of agreement goes and the funding is done, it's done.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other questions on item 26, committee, we'll go to item 27.
Mr. Chairman, item 27 is a $5,821,000 for the Justice Assistance Grants Program. This, Mr. Chairman, is a formula program that there is already an existing Justice Assistance Grants, and we've talked about that in this committee in years past. It is formula funding that comes to all the states. It goes to a single state administering agency for Alaska, that's the Department of Public Safety. The funds have a very broad purpose. Basically, they're for use to improve the criminal justice system and to improve enforcement. Of this stimulus package, which about $9.6 million, is going to the state of Alaska, all of the amount that's not listed here, we have $5,821,000 here. The remaining about $4 million goes directly to the larger municipalities in the state from the Department of Justice. It does not come through the state of Alaska. The $5,821,000 that would come to the state of Alaska, if we apply for it, of that, $1,282,000 is set aside or is specifically directed at local governments. It's an amount, it's a calculation made by the Department of Justice. They have a percentage, and when they give us the grant, they identify that amount that is to go to local governments. Typically, we will work with the smaller local governments that don't get direct grants, but we also can work with the larger governments. This is the same kind of a formula that exists in the current grants that we get on a regular annual program. What you see in here, Mr. Chairman, is six positions are proposed for the stimulus version of this grant. What we would like to do is increase our investigative capacity, particularly as it relates to sexual assault and child abuse and assault. The six positions would be five troopers, trooper investigators. There would be two of them in Fairbanks, two of them in Palmer, and one of them two in Anchorage, two in Fairbanks, one in Palmer. There would be one administrative position based in Fairbanks. The plan would also Once the positions were up and filled, the investigative positions were up and filled, would also pass through $150,000 annually to the Department of Law, with the expectation the Department of Law would probably create an attorney position to support, to offer the prosecution support to these investigations. And as you know, it's more than just taking something to court, it's doing all the work that goes along with an ongoing investigation. There would also be some funding, a smaller amount, passed through to the crime lab for supplies and equipment related to these kinds of investigations. There would also be a little bit that is related to internet crimes, but the focus would be on the sexual assault and the child abuse cases. What the department's preference would be, Mr. Chairman, is that at the end of the 3 years, we expect that these positions will have shown their worth, and we expect at this point in time that we would probably want to continue those positions. And we're being very upfront about that. You know, we have already committed, I think, to both subcommittees and both bodies, that over the course of the summer, we're going to do some long-range planning. We're going to work with some outside folks to do that. We believe we need more investigative resources. We've gotten to the point where we've been able to fill all of our positions, our trooper positions. And we believe now that we can reasonably say that if we add positions to increase our patrol capacity and our investigative capacity, that we can actually go out and find the folks to fill those positions and get out and do a more proactive law enforcement. We understand the concerns of everyone about what happens when the funding goes away, and that's why we're being very upfront here. Right at this point, our expectation would be that we would ask for those positions to be continued. We think they will have proven that it's good bang for the buck. Now, I should say, though, to be clear, that because this is a formula program, it's not a competitive grant application, that because of that and because of the broad nature of this program, if the legislature working with the governor were to say, you know, that's not the way we would prefer to see these funds used, then we could go back and come up with a plan B that would direct the funds towards other useful purposes. Our preference is for this, which I'll call Plan A, which is to increase our investigative capacity. We could put it towards equipment. We could put it towards some software improvements. We could direct all of it to municipalities who would do whatever they would do with it, you know, as long as it's within the purpose, the scope of the Justice Assistance Grants Program. That is a call ultimately for the legislature and the governor. This application, Mr. Chairman, is due April 9th. Now, if we apply for these funds using our preferred plan, which is these five troopers in one administrative position, and subsequent to that, the direction to us is change direction. Plan A is not what we want to do. Go with Plan B or C. Then we believe that we can amend our application. It wouldn't be the first time that a Justice Assistance Grant application has been amended, but this would be pretty wholesale. But it is a formula program. The question the Department of Justice looks at is, are you proposing to spend the money consistent with the purposes of the program? So there is flexibility here that you may not see in some other programs.
So just Senator Hoffman has a question, but before we get to Senator Hoffman, could you please clarify the application process? You said it is April 9th.
That is correct.
And has that been covered by the governor's letter to President Obama?
Mr. Chairman, I think the governor's letter to the president, in that letter, it mentioned ongoing work with the legislature on some of these programs that have other aspects to them, and this falls under that category. This is the ongoing discussion program. At this point, we're still in the will we do the application?
So at this point, we still need the application?
At this point, we still have not submitted the application. That is correct.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much of this domestic violence and sexual assault would be focused on, efforts would be focused in rural areas of the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, this would be, this particular thing would not be focused exclusively on rural areas of the state. It would be focused on anywhere that there's high incidence of this crime. Obviously, the rural areas are going to get a pretty significant focus here.
Well, you know, if the reason that I asked the question, Mr. Chairman, is that I understand the severity of child sexual abuse, but the problem primarily in rural Alaska is abuse of alcohol. And unless you can stem the abuse of alcohol, that is the cause for many of the incidences around not only domestic violence and child sexual abuse, but all the other crimes. And I think the department is well aware of that. And to me, it seems as though if we have one-time funds, at least for rural areas of the state, we should be looking at, is there any way that we can address stemming the flow of alcohol into rural areas that will result in reductions of not only domestic violence and child sexual abuse, but virtually all other crimes in rural areas of the state. And that is the stem of the problem. You know, if we go ahead and continue to address these problems of domestic violence and child sexual abuse and never get to the root of the problem, they're going to continue. And all we're going to be doing is putting those individuals in jail, and there's going to be other ones to follow. So I was wondering if any thought was given, at least in rural areas of the state, to address that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, yes, we have considered the issues of alcohol importation and alcohol abuse in the rural areas and all the attendant crimes that go with that.
Not only that, I think the enforcement of those laws, you know, that's the problem, is that we have a lot of bootlegging, and everyone in the communities, at least in the region that I represent, those people are identifiable, but the department hasn't proceeded in an aggressive program to target them. No sting operations. I know we have the WANT program, but their success rate in the last few years, in looking at the reports, is not very high. It seems as though that area needs to be beefed up, and it seems to me that this is a good time to do that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that, you know, I'm not intimately familiar enough with the mechanics of the program to discuss our success rate or lack thereof. Certainly, we know that it's a problem. Certainly, we are working on enforcement of that problem. We have ongoing requests for federal funds that focus on those problems, and I think there's federal funds in the capital budget that you've already heard that are directed to that.
But what I'm saying is I don't see the results. You know, I think that the efforts are not adequate, unless you can show me that there are results and we are being effective, and the need for domestic violence dollars is decreasing instead of increasing. Then I say that we are not being effective.
If we could, do we have any initial questions? Hey, Mr. Persley, if you have comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to clarify for members, as Mr. Spencer explained, there's $5.8 million coming to the state, of which $1.25 million has to go out to local governments. The $3.8 million that is going directly to 19 different cities and boroughs in the state is an allocation set by the Department of Justice. That's not a decision by the state as to which cities, which boroughs are getting how much. The municipalities have a May 18th deadline for their funds, and their funds are not subject to legislative appropriation. They go directly to them, and that would include Fairbanks, Anchorage, Bethel, Wasilla, Palmer, North Slope Borough, Dillingham, Sitka, a wide range across the state.
On dealing with the department count, because we are concerned on the growth of our operating account, we've struggled with that at the table here for the last few years. Would the department, through its natural evolution, increase the trooper count by six or more over the next several years? Or is this something that's added on top that wasn't even contemplated in any planning sessions of the public safety?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, we're planning on doing a long-range planning process this summer, a pretty extensive one. At this point, is our expectation that based on the crime rates that we see and the investigative resources that we need to have allocated to it, is at this point is our expectation that what this will say is we do need these positions. And rather than wait to put them on, we have this opportunity to put them on now. That's why we're presenting this as a preferred plan.
So what you're telling us is, from your perspective, you need them anyway, regardless of the stimulus package. It's just, when can you get them implemented?
That is correct.
And how many unfilled positions do you have in the public safety trooper arena?
Mr. Chairman, right at this point today, we have, excuse me, with the recruits that are in the academy and lateral applicants, which is police officers coming in from other jurisdictions that are already certified, we have no vacant trooper positions.
Okay, so you've taken care of that issue. Just, you know, for the people at home that are following this process, it's confusing enough in the building, much less for the folks outside of this that don't work with it every day. When we look at over the past 7 years from 2007 to when that's the conference committee or the adjusted end of the year 2007 budget to the governor's amended 2010, which is the budget we're working on today, working through the system, there's 1,957 full-time employees across the state, employee count increase. Again, that's 1,057. What we're talking about here is six troopers and possibly an attorney that may be embedded in the overall evolution of employee growth. On average, what that equates to without the stimulus is 392 positions since 07. On average, we've added every year, 392. I think what will come out in these hearings over the next few days from the meetings I've had with the staff that have been working diligently on this, there's roughly 18 in the stimulus package, 18. And there may be some discussion at this table to increase that count by 2 to 20. And by increasing it by 2 would help in addressing the accounting requirements and reporting requirements that will be faced around the different departments to meet the federal requests for tight monitoring. Well, if we're looking at a total strings attached to 20 people and a natural evolution of adding almost 400 per year, we just need to keep that into scale when we talk about the strings attached or the potential future increase in the operating budget. And we roughly grow our employee count 2% per year. So in the scheme of things, this is pretty or has a very little impact on our employee count. And apparently from your testimony, it appears that these six troopers are most likely going to be evolved into the operating budget requests coming into the future regardless of this stimulus package. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is our anticipation at this point. Obviously, things change, you know. The economic situation in the state could get worse. It could be that if this funding were not used for these positions or this purpose, you and the governor decided after these discussions that wasn't how you wanted to go and when we redirected it. And a year from now, we were saying that, you know, we've done this planning process and we still think we need these positions. But if oil was at $10 a barrel, we could be saying that for a long time. You know, that's part of the reason, Mr. Chairman, that we're being candid here. This is what we see. But again, as the governor has indicated, that there needs to be a public discussion, and that's what we're engaged in here.
And we do appreciate the candid discussion. It helps us make correct policy decisions. I just wanted to, for the people at home, to put this in the scale that we're dealing with here. So they don't fall into the soundbite and political spin from whatever avenue is delivering it. We're going to concentrate on headcount and budgetary impacts. Do we have any other questions on item number 27? Comments? Okay, thank you. We'll go to item 28. Again, we're working off the spreadsheet for the dated March 30th.
Mr. Chairman, item 28 is victim assistance formula grants of $545,000. These would go to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. This application, Mr. Chairman, has already been submitted. This is a formula program. The funding allocations are statutorily mandated, where 10% is allocated for domestic violence, 10% for sexual assault programs, 10% for child abuse programs, 10% for other violent crimes, and the remaining amount is for a variety of other issue areas. Mr. Chairman, this and the following item, which is 803.6, for the STOP, the Services Training Officers Prosecutors Grant, which is another formula grant, also would go to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and has also been applied for already. Both of these programs are, the funding will be passed through. They're not for specifically for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. There would be a competitive grant application process, just like we do for the existing funding that we get in a normal annual operating budget from the federal programs. The focus areas would be determined by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault prior to putting out the solicitation. Right at this point, what the department would likely recommend to the council is that this be focused on taking care of some immediate needs and not ongoing programs that would have costs after they were done. But that would, again, be up to the council to ultimately determine at the end of the day, subject to the guidance from the governor and the legislature.
Any questions on this one or the one previous? Mr. Persley, would you help us with 28 and 29, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The House Finance looked at this and saw them pretty simply as one-time boosts in federal funding to existing programs that have had strong support. We had no problems, no questions,
and
either of these.
And any type of strings attached or
Mr. Chairman, just reporting requirements, as our all of the stimulus provisions have some pretty strict reporting requirements, but nothing that you wouldn't deal with in the course of any other federal grant.
And then I was drifting off on another issue here. Could you repeat the issue on 28 and 29 of the application process, where that is, if it's been included in the governor's letter or excluded, or where that is?
Mr. Chairman, the application for both of these have been submitted for both of these grants programs.
And if I could back up, thank you, if I could back up just for a minute on the previous comment about employee count, just trying to help the people at home, the citizens at home that are watching this. We're talking about 18 to 20 people over this whole stimulus package, is the best information the legislature has at the moment. From last year's FY09 conference committee of budget, which is ending this year, ending in June, looking forward to next year, 2010, using the governor's amended budget for FY10, it's 148 position count increase, 148. And we're looking at here a total of 20. I just want people to keep that in mind when we go through this process, that we need to focus on the scale of what we're dealing with, which apparently is the inverse relationship what is presented in the press, in my impression of reading the press reports and press releases. So we're going to continually look for employee count and scrub those issues as we go forward over the next couple of days to make sure that we can do the best job we can anticipating impacts. Do we have, yes?
Mr. Chairman, this is Joellen Hanrahan, Senior Policy Analyst with the Office of Management and Budget. And I just wanted to follow up on a point that Mr. Persley touched on, and that is the reporting and tracking requirements, and that with all of these items that we're discussing today, for many of them, we have not received the final guidance from the federal government, and that will help us determine further really what are the reporting and tracking strings, as people are calling it, or requirements to that will cause extra work on the departments. I think that the level of increased reporting and tracking is acknowledged from the federal government on down, that there will be increased frequency and much more detail than regular standard federal programs, and that the states are considering this to be a burden where no funds have been placed in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for the reporting and tracking requirements. This was acknowledged yesterday or the day before at a meeting with the federal OMB and the states, where there was a long discussion on this issue. And one of the things that the federal OMB has started to look at is whether some of the fiscal stabilization funds can be used to help states address some of these increased reporting and tracking requirements, because they are definitely frequently beyond what's required in a federal program.
Okay. Mr. Persley, you had a comment, or are you just raising your hand?
Okay. No, sir.
Any other final comments from the department? I think that was your last item.
This is the last item that we have flagged for you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I should point out that there are three other programs that are not on the spreadsheet, and because they are competitive grant programs that where we would determine what, if we were going to apply, what we would be interested in applying for. We would make a proposal, apply for the grants, and we may or may not get them. And so they were not included on the sheet, but I do think that I should mention them. One of them is the COPS grant program. This is a competitive program in the stimulus. It's another one of these programs under the Department of Justice that there's already a counterpart on the annual federal budget. And there's a stimulus version of this that allocates $1 billion nationwide for basically hiring new police officers. Now, the nuance with this particular program is it has three purpose areas. One is new police officers. The other is for retaining police officers or law enforcement related positions that will be laid off because of state or local budget reductions, and it requires a certification that they would have been laid off before you can use federal funds. And the third area is that it is available to go out and fund positions where employees have already been laid off, where you can bring them back on. The application for this particular program is due April 14th. Now, this program comes with an immediate cost to anyone getting the grant, because it will fund the basic entry-level salary and benefits costs of the police officer, but it will not fund any of the other costs. It doesn't fund the training cost. It doesn't fund the equipment cost. It doesn't fund travel costs, if there are any. So additionally, that particular program at the end of 3 years, the funding is available over 3 years, but at the end of 3 years, once you've accepted the grant and funded these positions, you must agree to keep the position on for a fourth year fully on your own dime. So there's clearly a lot of strings attached to this one. And were we to do this or the other two that I'll mention here briefly, they would have much more of a rural focus on them. But the nature of, in the case of the COPS grants, the cost of that to the state, as well as the even if we did apply, the lack of we have applied over the last several years and have not gotten these competitive grants. And right at this point, I don't know that you know, we would be any stronger of a candidate today for the stimulus funds than we would otherwise. But this is a program that is out there. I did want to bring it to your attention. We have not made an application for it. If we were to apply, and it was the collective judgment that it's not something we want to do, we can withdraw the application. A second program out there.
Mr. Chairman.
Second here. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How complicated is the application process?
Basically, we identify what we're going to do with the funding. I mean, we put together a proposal and send it into them. It uses their forms and everything else. And then we don't know what their scoring criteria are, if you will, which takes the higher priority. But all things considered, given the nature of the stimulus bill, I would expect that the first priorities are going to be places where positions are going to be eliminated, people are going to be laid off, or people have already been laid off and could be rehired using these stimulus funds. So I would think that given the nature of any application that we might make, I would suspect that we would probably not be at the top of their list. But that is strictly speculation on my part.
Okay. Can you go ahead and continue with your item number two?
Mr. Chairman, the next one is burn competitive grants, which this one is it's a program that's also around, again, we've applied for funding from this before and have not gotten it any time recently. If we were to apply for this, we would focus on rural drug crimes, particularly those that have a federal prosecution nexus. We would be interested in doing new positions here. But again, this money, when it goes away, it goes away. And so it's sort of like the JAG funds that once the funding is over, if you intend to continue the positions or whatever it is that you're focused on, then the state or local government has to pick that up. The application here is due April 27th. So, presumably by then we'll all know how interested folks are in us actually pushing the button under the application. Okay. The third one, Mr. Chairman, is rural law enforcement. Applications are due on April 22nd. And our focus on this particular one would be to have three troopers that would be do VPSO oversight. And if I could, one of the reasons that we would think that we would need, in addition to, we can always use some more oversight and some more visit for VPSOs. But as you know, in the operating budget proposal that the governor's amendments presented, and I believe this committee adopted the VPSO task force recommendations, where there will be 15 additional VPSO positions added in FY10, and then the proposal from the task force called for another 15 positions in FY11 on top of 15 positions added in FY09. So that would mean 45 VPSO positions over a three-year, additional VPSO positions over a three-year period of time, recognizing the importance of having those services being provided in the rural areas. And so as we get to that point, we will need more troopers. At some point, the troopers will have to spend a significant amount more time working on VPSO oversight and training issues. And so this, if we apply, our proposal would be to bring on three troopers whose focus is on VPSO oversight and training.
Questions? The department. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The The second item that you had, you said there were no strings, so I'm assuming that the costs were completely taken care of in that case, direct and indirect ones, not just salaries and benefits, but other ancillary, I know you even, I don't know how you do it in Department of Public Safety, whether they actually, as in the personnel costs, even are including telephones, et cetera, and things like that.
On the justice assistance grants, is that what you're referring to?
The second one, yes, I believe
yes. The justice assistance grants will cover all the costs, and so that includes vehicles, training, equipment. I might add that on the COPS grants, the ones that I had mentioned that have a requirement right up front, that justice assistance grants funds can actually be used to cover some of those costs right up front. But at the end of the 3 years, no matter what, it's still it's on the state and local government to provide their own funds.
Go ahead, Senator Thomas.
And just one other question. You said in the first program, the COPS grant program, that you had applied unsuccessfully for several years. So there wasn't a concern at that time about strings being attached to
it? Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, good question. Had we received the application, we did not have a budget. We would have had to come to the legislature and say, we have this funding. We've gotten a grant. Are you okay with us spending it? There would still have been the review by the governor's office as well as the legislature.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Spencer, as we look at the items 3 and 4 of the Council on Domestic Violence, is $1.3 million is going there. And I see that going to victims of criminal violence and certainly training of law enforcement personnel. How much of that money is actually going to go to some of the shelters that are out there that are certainly necessary for these victims that are being abused?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, as I mentioned, this would be a competitive grant solicitation, but we would expect most of it would be going to the shelters, or at least, I don't know if I should say most of it, perhaps a significant amount of it. I suspect most of it goes to the shelters already. So
if I'm hearing what you're saying in excess of 50% is going to be available to these shelters that are out there that are in need at this time?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Chris Ashenbrenner from the council is available to answer that question. But I believe that.
Yes.
The requirements of the program identify the types of services that we can use it for. It doesn't say who, but in Alaska, a lot of those services are provided by the shelters.
Mr. Chairman, is it okay if I call up, if you
Yeah, we could ask
Mr. Ashenbrenner to clarify the answer.
Right, we'll have him come forward. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and then help the committee with the question, please.
Okay, I'm Chris Ashenbrenner, and I'm the executive director for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Most, as Mr. Spencer said, Mr. Chair, Senator, the great majority of the money will go out by RFP to victim service programs. The one grant, the STOP grant, which is a Violence Against Women STOP grant, about half of that is designated to go to law enforcement and prosecution, and a little bit to courts. But other than that, everything is expected to go to victim services programs.
Including the shelters?
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have been looking through the stimulus money and talking to folks because the Alaska Women's Aid in Crisis, the shelter there in Anchorage, a couple of blocks from my house, they have a boiler that's about to either explode or go out, and I'm afraid the entire shelter would be in a dire situation and would have to close down or ship people off somewhere. A completely unacceptable situation. So I've been looking around for capital monies or monies within the stimulus to deal with this. This may not be the pot of money for that kind of thing, but do you know of any emergency fund for a shelter that has a boiler that's about to go out?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, No, unfortunately, there isn't any capital improvement emergency funds or repair funds set up for shelters. So when shelters get into situations like this, we basically end up scrambling around trying to find a federal grant or some extra state money, some discretionary money that might be around to help them out. But this money could help. In fact, the department and I do both plan to recommend to the council that they target this RFP to shelters to use for repairs and maintenance and to fix their furnaces and get energy efficient windows and do those things that one-time money can do for them that will give them savings in the long run.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems as though that there's a lot of funds available for rural areas to apply for, but the state of Alaska's participation in the stimulus package seems to not be directed at rural areas and enforcement in rural areas of the state. And I wonder if you might comment upon that. Why do I get that feeling, and am I wrong in that perception?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, are you talking back about the justice assistance?
The overall package of public safety as the state of Alaska is applying for those dollars. I understand the flexibility of local governments to apply for funds, but I'm getting the impression that the funds that the state of Alaska is applying for is not directed at addressing public safety issues directly in rural Alaska. Even the troopers here, I don't see that they're going to be out in rural Alaska. They're going to be stationed in Anchorage and may have some peripheral interaction with rural Alaska. But I wonder if you could address my fears that rural Alaska is not getting adequate attention under the stimulus package that the state of Alaska is submitting.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, the investigators would be for all the state. They would go wherever we, and as I mentioned earlier, that would necessarily include the rural areas. I mean, we know we have a high rates of sexual assault and domestic violence out in the rural areas. And
But the problem is we have regional centers, Bethel, Dillingham, Kotzebue, Barrow, and if they're there, there's problems out in the villages. So they could exist there. If they're in Anchorage, they have to go through Bethel and then to Macoryuk or to Tuntutuliak or to Eek or to Kipnuk. You know, if they're in Kotzebue, they have to go to Buckland, or so they have to make more stops. So if we want to address the problems, you know, it seems as though we would take the state of Alaska could take a more regional approach to addressing the issues.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I can get a response to the committee on that particular issue. I simply can't give that to you right here at this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yeah, there'll probably be several departments that'll want to get back with answers. We don't expect you to have all the answers when you sit down at the end of the table, so we'll anxiously await your response. Any other questions for the Department of Public Safety? Okay, thank you for coming. Next up, revenue. And are you going to be point lady for revenue? Alaska Housing.
Mr. Chairman, Alaska Housing Finance is here. I wasn't sure whether you wanted Child Support Enforcement Division or the Alaska Housing Finance.
Well, if we're going to start on, I think we'll start on Child Support Services, I guess, and we'll go down from there. Let's go down the list.
And apparently I am point person on Child Support. Mr. Chairman, this is a little bit different. The Child Support Enforcement under the American Recovery Act is a little bit different than some of the other funding sources. This actually is a language change in the law that allows the Child Support Services Division to use existing federal incentive dollars as state match, which will allow them to get more federal dollars. That's a little bit different. This program is a federal financial participation rate of 66% and a state match requirement of 34%. In addition to that, the state receives federal funding in the form of earned incentive receipts. Traditionally, in the last several years, those earned receipts could not be used as part of the state match. The American Recovery Act changes that and allows states to use their federal incentive receipts as part of their state match. As a result of that, the state will be able to receive more federal funds. They would be able to receive up to $6.8 million. However, only $3.2 million could likely be collected over the next 3 years due to the division's actual expenditures. This particular request represents the FY09 and FY10 portion of those funds that could be received.
And that portion is?
That is, I believe it's 2.7. The total portion is 2.7, and the way this is addressed here has to do with budgeting issues. So I'm not as clear on explaining the exact transactions, but I'll give it a try. What they're able to do is reduce their other funds to increase the federal funds.
Let's just pause for a minute, make sure the chairman's on track. This item should be the item right above number 30 for $585,000. Unless I got high graded off onto the wrong page.
Doesn't have a number.
Doesn't have a number. It's above number 30. Top of the page, top of page 4.
And that's partly, Mr. Chairman, because both of those are really accomplishing the same thing. But the transactions, for technical budgetary reasons, had to be input separately. However, in total, this transaction allows the division to receive about $2.7 million in economic stimulus funds, and it will reduce their receipt-supported services and their regular federal. And in addition, there is a 400 general fund match that will be required.
Mr. Pursley.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can explain. The original fiscal year 2010 budget submitted by the governor asked for state money to replace the loss of federal funds. For at least 15 years prior to 2008, the federal government allowed states to use these incentive money that they received for successful child support operations. The federal government allowed states to use the federal incentive money to go get their 2-for-1 matching federal dollars for child support operations. In fiscal year 2008, a change in federal law took effect, and you were no longer able to turn federal dollars into state dollars for matching funds. So in this budget that was presented by the governor, there's a request for state funds to make up for that loss. I'm not a budgeting expert, but I know a lot of the numbers here are change records to diminish the need for new state funds and put in the federal stimulus funds and the incentive funds that we'll be able to get. So it reduces the need for state money and goes back to using federal dollars for child support operations.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that these transactions, there is no change in the total authorization dollars for the Child Support Services Division. That is merely a switching of funds.
So we're just taking some federal funds and supplanting some state funds.
We're reducing, yes, receipts, supported services, and we're also reducing the regular federal authorization.
And the application process of these two items, where's that at?
No requirement for an application.
Well, we could, could you answer that question?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the application process for this particular item. I do know that these federal incentive receipts can be used as state match for the period of from October 1st, 2008 through September 30th, 2010.
Okay, and Mr. Maloney, I think, is online from Child Support Services. Is that correct?
And Mr. Chairman, this is John Maloney. I'm the Director of Child Support Services. There's not a formal application for this. This is simply with our normal grant, which is an operating grant that we go from year to year. It's an open-ended grant based on actual expenditures.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the application for these funds divisible?
Mr. Maloney, can you help us with that?
I'm through the chair, Senator Hoffman. I'm not sure I understand the question, Senator Hoffman.
Well, they're in two sections, one for 585.5 and the other one for 718 with a $400,000 match. Can you apply for one and not the other?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman. No, you really can't. The application, there is no formal application other than the grant information that's provided, and it's based on actual expenses and how those expenses are divided between state funds, federal funds, incentive funds. And the reason that you see these additional numbers is because of the fact that, as Ms. Hanrahan was saying, it has to do with change records to make the budget what it should read, because there was some need for some state funds, there was need for less in funds from receipt supported services, and there was a requirement for originally for some funds for state general fund match money, and there was some excess already federal funds in there. So the reason you don't see a just one single number with a kind of a debit credit thing for one amount is because you're taking these from a couple of different places, some from receipt-supported services, some from the original federal match, and you're putting them into the stimulus package.
Okay, thank you. Have any questions, further questions on this issue? Or are these two, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, yes? This is Dwellin Hanrahan. I'd just like to note that this federal language does expire in 2010, and after that, the child support services.
Could you pull your microphone a little closer? I couldn't hear the year that you were saying.
Sorry. We're usually not that soft-spoken at OMB, but this particular language in the American Recovery Act expires in September 2010, and at that point, the Child Support Services Division will no longer be able to use the federal incentive funds as state match. I just want to note that.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any comments, Mr. Persley, on this issue before we move on?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We'll go on to I guess net revenues. Next item is number 35 on the page. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Just get, you got room for one seat, take your pick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Only enough room for one big guy, I can't get both of them on there, you know.
For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Number 35 is State Energy Program, U.S. Department of Energy. DOE funds for the State Energy Program special projects such as building technologies, codes and standards, wind and power technologies, renewable energy for remote areas, and transportation technologies. This is for $28,563,000, and it is contingent on the pursual of a statewide energy code. The state would have 8 years to comply, and compliance after an eight-year period would be a minimum of 90% of the state would have to be energy efficient. The history of the statewide energy or state energy program was we've been getting a relatively small amount of money from the federal government on a yearly basis, around $300,000. This year it's about $360,000. And how it has traditionally been split is the Alaska Energy Authority and ADA receives 50% of the funds, and AHFC receives 50% of the funds. AHFC is the energy agency for the state, but AEA obviously plays a large role more on the supply side, where Alaska Housing is more on the demand side, energy efficiency and that aspect of it. I have a very rough draft of should AHFC receive the half of this, like it has traditionally been done, how the funds would be spent. Approximately $2 million on weatherization and rebate support for software enhancements, including setting up a statewide baseline data collection and a green construction element. Also expanding the energy audit program to cover commercial, state buildings, schools. $4 million for home-based renewable energy program that would have to do with smart metering and net metering. $1.8 million for consumer education, energy efficiency awareness campaign, workshops for contractors and builders, consumer workshops through the University of Alaska Fairbanks, retrofit manual production and reprints, realtor workshops, website maintenance, approximately $4.5 million for weatherization of community buildings. I know you're all aware of the $200 million we received in weatherization funds last year and the $160 million for home energy rebate program. That is strictly residential, and this would focus on community buildings. And $2 million for statewide energy standards that would work on a statewide energy code, developing standards for public buildings and commercial buildings. And the passage of an energy code statewide would not only include residential, but it would include commercial. And as you're probably aware, since 1992, AHFC has by statute had to comply with what's known as BEES, B-E-E-S, the Building Energy Efficiency Standards, that's in statute, and any house built after 1992, we cannot finance unless they match up to those standards. So we are very familiar with the residential aspect of energy. We are not commercial at all. There have been discussions with the state fire marshal, and they've said they have had nothing to do with energy codes for residential or commercial. We're statutorily residential. We're not commercial. If a policy decision was made by the governor and the legislature to go this direction, then it would be up to the policy decision on who would be pushing the commercial code, whether it would be split between AHFC for residential and ADA or somebody else for commercial, or whether it would all be under one umbrella.
If you could maybe help us a little bit, there's definitely some strings attached to this one that appear to exist dealing with our code requirements coming in our 8 years to come into compliance with whatever they are. But you mentioned we need to become 90% energy efficient. My understanding, there's a difference between commercial and residential, and is it square footage or permits, or how is this thing calculated, and how would we know for in or out, and where is it weighted, square footage? Is there square footage in commercial, or is it dominated by residential, or do you know?
I believe it is by square footage, and it would apply to any new homes built after the date in which we accept the funds, or any renovations done to any homes. It wouldn't existing buildings that have already been built and were not renovated during that 8-year period would not be included in the 90% compliance, but I know we've got folks online that can give you more details on that if you'd like.
Okay, and then on the dominance of square footage between residential and commercial, can you give us any idea on where that is?
I do not know that off the top of my head. We might want to check with Bob Green or John Anderson up in our Anchorage office, and they may have a better idea.
They may, but they're not available. Mr. Persley, you have a question.
Just to clarify, Mr. Chairman, the law says that within 8 years of the enactment, so that would be by 2017, at least 90% of new and renovated residential and commercial square footage must be in compliance with energy efficiency standards. So as we've been reading it, it lumps residential, commercial together. So within 8 years, 90% of the square footage of that combined total, new and renovated, would have to meet the standards.
So when we, help me a little bit, when we build buildings, large commercial buildings, which are normally built in Anchorage relative to the rest of the state, do those meet the code currently, or how far off are they? Or we're looking at big changes here, little changes? What are we faced with?
And Mr. Chairman, this is Brian Butcher. Speaking on the residential side of it, most of the communities that have building codes build up to the residential energy code standard of approximately 4-star plus, which would include Anchorage and the city of Fairbanks and Kenai and a lot of the urban areas. In terms of rural Alaska, most of the loans in rural Alaska are done through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So as a result, a fairly good percentage, and I don't know the number off the top of my head either, of rural Alaska would fit under those standards because that's what they need to do to get an HFC loan.
I thought we were getting away from the STAR system. Is that not correct, or that whole rating scenario?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Persley, you look like you're dying.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could just add something. It's our information that on, as you mentioned, the larger commercial buildings in Anchorage, where the bulk of the square footage is going to be, and particularly those that are financed, they're already going to meet or be pretty close to the energy efficiency standards that are required under this act.
Okay. Could you tell us if the new meeting hall in Anchorage that the state built is next to the Atwood is in compliant or not? I mean, that's a brand new, real fancy, high-end building.
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that, but I'm going to hope they are.
And Mr. Chairman,
but I could find out. That's a good question, as an example.
I think that's the building that comes to mind as far as the latest and greatest building we've built. Senator Ellis, you have a.
Mr. Chairman, do you mean the Denina Convention Center?
Yes, the big convention center.
No state funds were involved.
Okay, well, I misspoke on that, but
it's a great building, though.
It is a. It's a building we should all be proud of.
And Mr. Chairman, I will find out if that meets the current standards.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we're the residential side of it. We know very little about the commercial, but in talking to folks, I've been told that in most cases, when the banks do a loan on a commercial building, having energy efficiency as part of it, they're not interested in borrowing on a, you know, fairly low energy efficient building. They're interested in borrowing on something that's going to be built a little bit better and last a little bit longer.
So how burdensome on a citizenry is this string attached to meet these code requirements if we head down this road?
Mr. Chairman, it would be right off the top, it's approximately $300 to pay an energy rater to get a rating that would qualify right now for HFC's Bs. So that would be something that would be required to be done. In terms of what the average amount of money would be that folks would have to put in that they're not currently putting in areas that don't have building codes, we've been told by builders that it's in most cases in the $5,000 to $8,000 range is what they have to put into it to take a building up to a high enough level to make it qualify as energy efficient. But obviously that's going to vary with the size of the home, the area of the state, and, you know, different variables.
And I'm not real familiar, coming from an area that has enforceable building codes, with areas that don't have those in the state. is most of the metropolitan areas under the International Building Code, or what?
Mr. Chairman, this is Joellen Hanrahan, Senior Policy Analyst at OMB. In answer to your question, there are 13 communities with some type of code at this time. There are three or four of those have the 1997 Uniform Home Building Code. Only two parts of the state have a energy code, and that would be Anchorage and Fairbanks, and they are now operating under the 2006 code. The American Recovery Act requires that we go with the most recent version, which is the 2009. It was just passed recently. Obviously, Anchorage covers a large portion of the population, but we have about 385 communities in the state, and there are, one of the things that also has to be considered here in cost is the cost for those inspectors to travel, and that would be on the homeowner for the inspectors to travel to the remote areas. Currently, 40 communities have coverage with some type of energy certifier, either a BEES compliance certifier or the energy rating certifier. So approximately 40 communities out of 385 have some type of energy person now.
Could you get that list to the committee so we can take a look at that list, and then what?
Absolutely.
Because you said, what did you say there was 13 communities that have building codes?
13 communities now have some type of code, have some type of building code. Only two communities have a energy code in force, and there are two other communities that are looking at having a energy code in force.
I guess I'm not connecting the dots here. Ketchikan, Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, they all have building codes. How do we only get to 13? I mean, that's just in Southeast, and as we go north,
right.
There's only 13.
I can name the ones for you if you want. If you're talking specific to a building code, which is different from an energy code.
Right.
From a building code, there is Anchorage, City and Borough of Juneau, Mat-Su Borough, Fairbanks, Kenai, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Nome, Palmer, Petersburg, Valdez, and Wrangell, and Skagway.
And Sitka's not on there?
Ketchikan either.
Okay, they said Ketchikan. Okay.
They are not. I don't believe they're on here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we want to check that list because I can assure you that the building inspector knows my address. They've been around, and we've called for inspections. So we can
get back to you on this list. This actually was a list that also came from compiled by LAA Research, and also AHFC looked at this and thought it was fairly accurate.
And then I'm interested in the breakdown of the. This year for federal funds is $28.5 million rounded off, and you were talking about a 50-50 split. Could you provide the committee with a breakdown on Alaska Housing's portion of that? And I guess we need to find out what AEA is going to do with their portion.
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have other questions on this item? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Realizing there is, in many areas, a lot of resistance to codes being expanded, you know, into maybe more the areas that surround some of the cities that do have, cities and towns that do have codes, as well as energy codes, as well as building codes. With that in mind, the amount of money that is being expended by the state now, hundreds of millions of dollars in weatherization and other programs like that. In your opinion, is this a good idea or a bad idea in the long run for us to put the money, take the money, and even though there are some requirements required, that we look forward to saving money in the long run because we are preparing the homes better rather than expecting that we're going to continue to pour money into programs to redo homes rather than build them correctly in the beginning unless the code requirements under this particular, under the stimulus package are so onerous and such high standards that we believe that they would be difficult to attain.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, that is, and we're trying to compile that right now, the policy question there for the governor and the legislature is going to have to do with, is the benefit of the energy codes worth what the cost is going to be, the expense is going to be, the inconvenience, and that's something we're trying to figure out right now. We have a fairly good handle on the residential aspect of it. We don't at all on the commercial aspect of it in terms of what it would cost, Alaskans, what would need to be done, because the reality is on the residential side of it, most homes are being built up to this standard right now. So would the passage of a state energy code make a large difference on the residential side? Probably not. Commercial, I don't know the answer to that question. So this is really one of those programs that the gathering of information and weighing the pros and the cons is really going to play a large role in trying to figure out if it makes sense for this state.
Senator Thomas, follow up?
Yes, just thank you, Mr. Chairman. The application period for this, for these programs is?
All three programs I'll be talking about. The drop-dead date that you have to have it in by is May 14th.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This all applies to new construction. But do you loan money if the on a new construction, if the blueprints say that it is going to meet the requirements, and that's the only requirement, or do you have to, the blueprints have to meet that, and then you have to have a follow-up inspection to verify?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, you have to have an energy rater come in and sign off on it and get the paperwork to us to confirm that it is, in fact, a four-star plus or higher home.
And these acceptance of these dollars applies only to new construction?
New construction and renovation, which is, I don't know if there's a definition in the bill or not, but it is more than just spending $2,000 to put new insulation in.
Can you help the community a little bit with, does this include potentially all residential new construction or just new construction financed through Alaska Housing? Or?
Mr. Chairman, a state energy code would require all construction, all new construction. Right now, any new construction financed through AHFC has to pass the B standard. And that's been that way for 17 years.
And if I wanted to go up and, as a hypothetical example, and build a cabin next to my colleague here, Senator Hoffman, to help him catch his fish before he catches them, would that cabin have to come into compliance?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that question. Maybe Larry does. I know that we only fund owner-occupied homes, so if that was a recreational cabin, that's not something we could even have a mortgage on. But
the question is, would it fall under this code if we adopted it, the energy code?
Maybe I could answer it, Mr. Chairman. Our research to this point in House finance is that if the states adopted an energy efficiency code, the state could put exemptions in there. There was some discussion of cabins without running water or electricity or such. You know, again, under the provision of the Stimulus Act, you've got to come to 90% compliance or compliance on 90% of your square footage. So certainly exempting cabins and other minimal structures is not going to seriously jeopardize that 90% level on new structures, but our initial research shows that the state, in adopting an energy efficiency code, can put in exemptions and tries to tailor to local needs.
And then is there a lot of complementary synergy if we head this direction with what is in place already in the state with the existing program? What's the marginal benefits, another way of putting it?
Mr. Chairman, on the residential side of it, like I mentioned before, I don't think it would be a huge jump in energy efficiency of new construction because most of them are now being built on the commercial side, I don't know. I'm sure it would be some improvement. I would imagine it wouldn't be tremendous just because most commercial buildings are probably building to, it's in their own best interest to be energy efficient. But we don't. Since we know so little on the energy, on the commercial side of it, we don't have an answer.
Okay, and then as I recall, there's $20 million in the FY010 capital budget for Alaska Housing. Does any of that get supplanted by this stimulus money?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to follow up on a couple of questions, and one was related to the question on your cabin. At this time, we don't know of any exemptions that were outlined in the law for complying with the state energy code. We have put forth some questions to the Department of Energy, and we're asking their legal counsel because we believe that an answer from the legal counsel is probably the way we need to go. With respect to items like, are we able to make any exemptions based on, based on the situation in Alaska, but also on areas where there's no local organized form of government with a code authority? What is the state required? What is state government required to do in that situation? Are we required to implement, and how would we enforce it in those areas where there is no local code? We also think, a point of discussion, of course, is the preemption of local control and the right to adopt any varying codes in any of these communities. And on the issue of the 90% compliance, that's an extremely high demand to meet 90% compliance. And we keep hearing the square footage issue, but we haven't seen in law that the means of meeting that compliance is square footage. The law simply says there must be 90% compliance of new construction or renovated space. Whether whether that's going to be measured in number of units or square footage or by population really is yet to be known. And that is also one of the issues, is we do not have final guidance from the federal government on this program yet. So we're not even fully aware of what those full requirements would be for this program.
Senator Hoffman.
But the fact of the matter is that Alaska is the state that has the highest energy needs, the highest energy costs, and we are the state that would benefit the most by having the energy standards. So it would seem that we would be the state that probably would come into compliance versus states in the southwest or the southeast. So I think they would have more questions about whether they wanted to take this on, but as a state that has the highest energy standards, I think that we have to think very seriously of denying these funds.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could clarify one point. In the law, as we talk about energy codes, what it says is the states have to meet or exceed either the standards, the International Energy Conservation Code, or there's another one, or achieve equivalent or greater energy savings. So they don't really care whether you adopt the code or your own code that meets or exceeds the same energy savings. That's what they're getting at, is savings, not necessarily verbatim, line by line, that code.
Senator Hoffman.
Then I guess my question is, if we don't accept these funds, are they restricted to energy projects in other states, and vice versa? If other states don't accept these funds, can we get additional funds if we're going to meet these requirements so that we can bolster the energy efficiency for Alaskans?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I'm not sure I completely understand the question. You're asking whether we would get additional federal funds if we do not accept these funds?
No, I'm saying that if other states, if we don't accept these funds, other states can accept them and use them in the same category, and vice versa. If California says that, hey, we don't want to, it's too costly for us to come up to those standards, and we're living in a warm climate, so we're not going to take the federal dollars, can we go ahead and apply for those federal dollars and keep the same standards, so we would end up with way more money, and it's to our advantage to do so. So that the question is, you know, if other states forego their dollars, can we access them?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, in several instances in this American Recovery Act, that is true, that where states do not use the money, they will be reallocated to other states. And I think, in particular, transportation was one of the areas that was defined in law. I'm not as clear in this area, and I'm not sure whether Larry has that information or not, whether those would specifically be reallocated to another state for energy purposes. But we can follow up on that and get you that defined answer.
We have any other final comments, questions on this issue? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the 90% compliance, how would we assure that? If we put the codes in place, how would we assure whoever we're supposedly having to assure that we have attained 90% compliance? And what's the penalty if we aren't able to or don't?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, some of these funds would be used in trying to develop software that would allow us to track this kind of thing, since it's not something we've done previously. And I think Mr. Pursley had talked to somebody at DOE about what happened after 8 years. I haven't had a conversation.
Mr. Pursley?
I did have a conversation with someone at Department of Energy headquarters who presented the question, what if 8 years from now Alaska's at 73% compliance on square footage, what would happen? And they said, well, you probably won't be the only state, and we don't know.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to follow up with that conversation to say that I've had several conversations with the Department of Energy, and depending upon who I'm talking to, I'm getting different answers. And that's one reason why we are considerate to be really prudent and take the conservative approach and get these answers in a written form from the Department of Energy, and particularly from their legal counsel. And what would happen if we did not, if either the state did not put in a state energy code or the local authorities did not put in a state energy code, and exactly what happens if we don't meet the 90% compliance.
Okay. Senator Thomas.
It's doubtful that the reply would be the formal reply. So anyhow, thank you.
Okay, let's move on to item number 36, please. Item number 36, weatherization.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. HFC weatherization program, the U.S. Department of Energy funds to assist low and moderate income families attain decent, safe, and affordable housing through the weatherization and rehabilitation of existing homes. Weatherization also provides fire safety through furnace and electrical repairs, education, chimney and wood stove repairs, and egress windows installed during bedroom window replacements. For $18,466,200, how these funds would be administered is they would be along with the funds we received last year, the $200 million from the legislature. And we've historically received about $2 million from the federal government for weatherization. One thing they did with these funds is they increased the limit on who could qualify for these funds from 150 to 200% of poverty, upgrading their definition of low income. And the previous amount of federal funds that could be put into a home was $2,500, which in particular in Alaska is not very much money. That's been updated to $6,500. And they increased the amount of appropriated funds that can go towards training and technical assistance from 10% to 20%. So these would just be administered as additional to the $200 million in the program we're already administering. The one question that we have out there is this program has always been specifically exempted from Davis-Bacon wages, because the amount of money was so small per home and for low income that it would be cost prohibitive to not. But the passage of the bill, Davis-Bacon wages, it was included for the entire bill. So we're now in the process of trying to find out from the Department of Energy if this is still exempt or not. All 50 states are in the same situation, and obviously the dollar will go a lot further as the weatherization program is traditionally run, as opposed to this amount of funding having the qualification for Davis-Bacon wages. It would also make it more difficult to administer if, interior weatherization received 80% of their money in state funds and 20% of their money in these funds, and it would have to be allocated, so some people would be paid more money working on some things compared to the other people on the crew working on another. So all 50 states are kind of in the same boat here, and we have not received any information on that from the Department of Energy. But that's kind of the one question that's really sitting out there for us.
So those folks sitting at home that are thinking about possibly, here there's wood stove repairs and egress windows, say somebody remodeling a bedroom and they're going to enlarge their egress window, what kind of impact is that to dealing with the Davis-Bacon issue when they call up their local carpenter or contractor to come out and whack a hole in the wall, put a new window in?
Mr. Chairman, these would apply to the weatherization program that is weatherization crews that come in and do the energy audit and then figure out what happens to your home. So it wouldn't get into the situation of a homeowner hiring a contractor. It would be internal accounting for that would have to be done by the five weatherization providers that Alaska Housing works with across the state: Tanana Chiefs, Interior Weatherization, Municipality of Anchorage, Rural Cap, and Alaska Community Development Corporation.
Do any of those pay Davis-Bacon wages now or unionized?
They do not, Mr. Chairman, because we've had these, we've worked with these weatherization contractors for years, and this program has always been specifically exempted.
Okay. Any questions on this? This one, Senator Thomas, you've got a grin on your face.
I was just saying, that was probably a good opportunity for a time to change. You know,
I figured you'd have something to say on that.
A little broader opportunity for people, you know, and spread a little more of the money around. Thank you, though. Yeah,
thank you. Okay, seeing no other questions on item 30, we do have one. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to note that the Davis-Bacon issue is a national issue that's being discussed, not just with respect to weatherization, but to several of the other stimulus programs also. Every dollar that's spent out of the American Recovery for hiring workers they're supposed to meet the Davis-Bacon Act, and the federal OMB has this as one of their top issues that is being looked at.
Okay, thank you. Remember when I used to work construction, I liked the making bacon when we had those projects, is what we called it. Item 37.
Item 37, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, hold it there. Senator Hoffman.
On all of these, on the weatherization, does the administration have a position on adoption of the code? And what's their inclination to accepting these dollars?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, at this point in time, it's my understanding there's been no change in the governor's position, which has been that these are items that would increase our budget or have some or possibly place a burden on Alaskans, and that they are open for discussion, on the table for discussion with the public and with the legislature. That is where they stand at this time.
What about specifically to the building code requirements?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, at this time I have no information that any of these requests are in any other standing than being open for discussion with the public and the legislature.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to item 37.
Item 37, Mr. Chairman, is energy efficiency and conservation block grants. The Federal Department of Energy funds for activities for communities, including but not limited to developing and implementing an energy efficiency and conservation strategy, retaining technical consultant services to assist in the development of such a strategy. When we came in with the first spreadsheet, this amount of, the level of funds was 8.5 million. In the last week, we've been informed that it's actually higher than that. So it's been amended up to $9,593,500. That's what would come in to AHFC. There's also 4.3 million of direct grants to municipalities that would come from this. And
Mr. Pursley.
Mr. Chairman, maybe to just expand a little bit on what Mr. Butcher said. Correct, there's 9.5 million coming into the state. The law says that not less than 60% of that state allocation, not less than 60% of the 9.5 million must be granted to the communities that did not qualify for funding directly from the Department of Energy. There are 20 communities getting funding directly from the Department of Energy. That totals almost 4.5 million, and that's the 10 largest cities, 10 largest boroughs. So it's Anchorage, Fairbanks, Bethel, Denali Borough, Ketchikan, Gateway Borough, Sitka, North Slope Borough. It spreads around the state.
And Mr. Chairman, 2% is designated for Indian tribes, and 2% is competitive.
And Mr. Chairman, just if I could add one other thing, the money that's going directly to the communities, that $4.5 million does not go through the legislature and is not subject to the state's application or the state's consent or certification. That will go out on its own.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
How is the amount determined for each of those 10 communities?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it's federal law, federal allocation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Unfortunate we can't trump the feds. We would like all appropriations to come across our table. We have any other questions on the revenue? I think that's the last revenue item.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you for coming today. The next item up is health and social services, but we're basically out of time here. We have about 6 minutes left. So what I think we'll do is we'll stand in recess till 1:30. We'll pick up health and human, or health and social services, which has 7 items, and then we'll finish up with environmental conservation, and I think they have 1 item, and that way we'll be on track for tomorrow. So we're in recess till 1:30. I'd like to bring the Senate Finance Committee to order. We're going to continue to work on Senate Bill 161, Appropriations, and I see there's no camera in here for the people at home, so that'll speed things up, unless I see people come in from the public in the audience, because most of us have been through this several times. So we're going to start with Hess, but Mr. Pursley has a couple of comments from earlier this morning dealing with energy efficiency. If he could spin the committee up on those, and then we'll start on item 12.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Larry Pursley, an aide in House Finance and Representative Hawker's office. The question came up this morning during the discussion of the energy efficiency standards as they apply to commercial property, whether the new Denina Convention Center in Anchorage meets or exceeds the standards, and I want to report to the committee that I've spoken with the engineer of record for the building, who confirmed that the convention center does conform with all the standards. He also explained the standards have become common practice in the industry, and that among new commercial buildings or public buildings have been put up in Alaska that conform to the standards. JL Towers, Providence Medical Offices, the Goose Creek Correctional Facility, Center Point West in Anchorage all meet the standards. His quote was, "It's well established that these codes save you money on the operation of the building and are common practice."
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll have to deliver that message to our colleagues at Senate colleagues here that since all three of them are missing, we'll pass it along. If we could start with item number 12, which is on page 105 on the spreadsheet with the Health and Human Services.
Thank
go ahead
you.
And introduce yourself.
Thank you, record. Mr. Chairman. My name is Allison Elgee. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services in the Department of Health and Social Services. Item number 12 is an item that relates to the funding in the stimulus bill being provided for health information technology. Health information technology has a variety of benefits that have been identified in terms of improving healthcare quality, preventing medical errors, reducing healthcare costs, and increasing administrative efficiencies, decreasing paperwork, and expanding access to affordable care. The concept is to move providers to electronic medical records and then provide an exchange environment in which those medical records can be safely transferred from one entity to another and avoid duplication of expensive testing. What you see included on your spreadsheet is $2 million item. This is a placeholder. This is a area of the economic stimulus funding where very, very little guidance has as yet been provided. There is $20 billion in total for the program nationally, and there will be money available for capital as well as grants to providers to assist in their conversion to an electronic environment. However, we do not know what the what kinds of strings are going to be attached to this money, because as I said, at this point in the process, there's very little information available from the federal government. This does have a longer time horizon than many of the elements of the economic stimulus. This money is going to be available through 2015. And however, under the proposal in the bill, the money will carry a match rate initially of 10% for the administrative functions, and that match rate will increase as we move out on this time horizon, I believe 10% per year.
Okay, we have, it looks like an additional four positions on item 12, and we have a GF match of 40,000. So those, I guess, we'd consider those a form of the strings attached. But we earlier this morning had talked about before the total position count in this entire stimulus bill being somewhere around 18 out of about an average of right under 400 that we add per year to the state headcount. Senator Pascavan has Senate Bill 133 that creates an electronic health information exchange system. And I'm just wondering if you could help us with that issue as far as the stimulus money, and is it complement this bill or doesn't complement this bill, or you don't, or you support the bill, don't support it, or how do these two interplay?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 133 deals with the same subject matter, the creation of a health information exchange. And it utilizes, in the suggested fiscal note, the economic stimulus funding. I do want to be clear, however, what we did in developing that fiscal note was project what we believe to be the real cost of creating that exchange without clarification from the federal government about whether, in fact, all of those federal funds will be available to us. Because as I said again, though, money, the rules, the allocation, those areas are as yet unknown. The money that you're seeing here on your spreadsheet was intended initially as a placeholder because we do know that there is a significant planning effort that will be involved in terms of trying to put this together, and there will be
large effort engaged just to meet the HIPAA requirements that will be involved in assuring privacy of patient records.
So do you, does the department support the Senate Bill 133 and electronic records, or do you want to respond back to that later?
Senator Stedman, the department supports the concept. It is as yet difficult for us to make any statement regarding the economic stimulus funding because of all of the unknowns.
Okay. And you're up next.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, through the chair. Just to elaborate on that a little further, the state would administer the grants that go to healthcare providers across Alaska. One of the provisions of the stimulus bill is that healthcare providers could be eligible for up to $67,750 each, spread over 6 years, to help pay for the implementation of electronic medical records. It's a $21,000 maximum grant the first year, $8,000 something each of the next 5 years. So as Allison Elgee explained, this is a multi-year effort to get all health care providers into an electronic medical records, with the state supervising or administering it under very strict privacy rules.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the villages and the health aides and the medical records that are generated out in rural Alaska where you've got difficulties with bandwidth, how do you plan on implementing, or is this, first of all, is it included in the overall plans for this? And
through the chair, Senator Olson, we do recognize that there are significant bandwidth issues. In looking at that, the nonprofit group, the Alaska Health Electronic Health Network nonprofit group, actually conducted a study with GCI, and it's my understanding that based on that study, they're estimating the need for approximately $13 million to improve the bandwidth in rural Alaska to make this work effectively.
Ms. Barsley?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, maybe I can add, there's $7.2 billion in the economic stimulus bill that is going to go out as grants and loan guarantees for the expansion of broadband services, particularly in rural areas. So hopefully this could be coordinated so those areas of Alaska that are underserved or unserved by broadband could be brought up to speed. But those are going to be competitive grants, and the federal government has not yet set out the rules for that money.
Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear in my mind, so these competitive grants are against, are amongst the, or between the three big telecommunications people here in Alaska, which is GCI, AT&T, and ACS?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the two federal agencies running the competitive grant programs for broadband have not set the criteria, but it appears they'll be available to utilities, cooperatives, local governments in some case. It's going to be pretty broad availability.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on this item? Let's go to item 13. Item 13 appears to be a block grant, so it should be fairly fast.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 13 is an expansion of the Child Care Development Block Grant funding. There is in total available just slightly over $4 million through through December 31st of 2010. The restrictions on this money are that we cannot supplant or replace state funding with this increase, and a portion of the money must be targeted for quality expansion, $333,660, and $193,232 must be targeted funding for activities that improve the quality of infant and toddler care. We have been working closely with the Department of Education and the Best Beginnings Group and have a number of recommendations for these quality improvements that this funding could be utilized to meet, and it would be done on a one-time basis. However, the balance of the funding would be to improve access to child care assistance for things like a reimbursement of the rates charged for child care, increasing that reimbursement rate, or expanding eligibility. Those uses of the funding would create a continuing need for funding once the economic stimulus money runs out.
OK. Okay. Mr. Pursley, if you want to have any brief comments on the, any strings attached to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, we had no problems with this issue in House Finance.
So you found no strings attached to this issue?
It's an ongoing program, additional funding, but no strings or problems that, that we saw looking through it.
Okay. Let's go to item 14. Item 14 is a little different. We'll take a little more time on that. If you can explain item 14, please.
Mr. Chairman, the federal government food stamp program has been renamed SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and that's what is referenced in item 14. The money for the food stamp program does not flow directly through the state, but we do administer this program on behalf of the federal government, and we are provided administrative funding. There is an increase in the food stamp benefit available to all recipients effective April 1st. This funding is being made available to the state to cover the administrative costs of making the changes in our program administration pieces, as well as doing additional outreach.
Mr. Pursley?
Very good presentation, and we had nothing to add in House Finance.
Okay, so there was no strings attached other than the administrative end, and then those would be reimbursed or paid for by the feds, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, do we have any questions from the committee members? Okay, item 15, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is additional funding that may be available for the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program, also administered through the Division of Public Assistance. This particular program eligibility is going to be caseload driven, and we do not yet know whether or not we will qualify. But should our caseloads make us eligible for funding, we estimate that $777,000 will be available to the state.
Mr. Pursley?
Mr. Chairman, we had no issues with this funding.
No strings attached found?
No.
Negative impacts to the state. Does any committee members have any questions on this item? Okay. We're on item 16.
Mr. Chairman, item 16 is another area where we essentially have made a best guess about what may be available to the state through three different public health programs. As yet, we're getting very little guidance from the federal government about these programs, but there is additional funding available for immunization grants, for grants for community-based prevention and wellness strategies, and for grants to implement infection reduction strategies. We anticipate that these will most likely be competitive grants, but as yet, our federal partners have not been able to give us any additional information.
Mr. Pursley?
Mr. Chairman, we found no issues here other than just the ongoing issue of making sure that we properly account, monitor, and follow the rules, but nothing else.
Okay, so this falls into the accounting and reporting burden. Any questions from the committee members? Item 17.
Item 17, Mr. Chairman, is an expansion of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act Part C funding, which goes to our infant learning programs. This would essentially expand the program as we currently know it. We would focus on one-time infrastructure improvements, such as converting providers to electronic education records and improving Medicaid claiming opportunities were we to receive this money.
Mr. Pursley?
Mr. Chairman, we had no problems, no issues, no concerns with this item.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. And the last health and social services item, number 18.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 18 is an expansion of the grant program through the Administration on Aging for home-delivered and congregate meals that are provided through our senior centers throughout the state. This is in the amount of $485,000. It would be money that would pass through the state as grants to those senior centers that are already a part of the existing Commission on Aging grant program.
Mr. Pursley?
Mr. Chairman, nope. The only issue we had here was reminding everyone that they are the one-time funds and would go away with the stimulus. That was it.
Any questions on health and social services? Seeing none, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
And we have one other additional item, environmental conservation, item number 34. They have one item up. And then after this item, that will conclude our work today. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and help us with item number 34, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Maher. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for DEC. Item number 34 on your spreadsheet adds to a small program that we currently have and would allow us to provide grants predominantly to the rural areas of the state for diesel emissions reduction. There's a number of projects, and we sent a list out. I think you folks have, but it's, you know, anywhere from replacing diesel generators, repowering or replacing state, municipal, or school bus fleets, plug-in heaters to keep engine warms, and converting vehicles from diesel power to natural gas or propane. We are asking for no additional positions to run this small program, and the only issue that we're aware of is that this program does need grant authority, and we've provided the language to Larry and to the committee aides.
Okay, so what we have here is a grant that needs some statutory work, grant authority.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Senator Olson, you have a question?
No, I didn't, sir.
Mr. Pursley, you want to comment on this item?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I believe there's legislation in this body that moved through Senate Labor and Commerce yesterday on this grant authority, I'm confusing that with another bill. Sorry. Yes, this program has had a few hundred thousand dollars a year, which they have RSA'd to the Department of Transportation and the Alaska Railroad in past years, but with this $2 million stimulus fund that can go to municipalities, the department needs granting authority so it can disperse the money. This is funding that's being given to the states under the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act. So the point is to use the money to reduce emissions and save energy.
And this is a one-time grant?
There may be, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, there may be some additional funding downstream, but we're not sure of any of the amounts.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the committee members? Seeing none, thank you for hanging around today.
Thank you.
And adjusting your schedule so we can stay on track. That concludes the agenda today. The next meeting is tomorrow. We'll start at 9 a.m. April 3rd. We'll continue to work on SB 161 economic stimulus. As a reminder, we'll hear from the Department of Labor, the Administration and Commerce, and Education. Also on tomorrow's schedule, we've added Senate Bill 88, Power Cost Equalization. See everybody tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., meeting adjourned.
9 a.m. sharp.
9 a.m.